This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today are Steve Wise, who's director of the Parris Island Museum at the Marine Base there on Parris Island, and my longtime friend, Professor Larry Rowland, who's Professor Emeritus of History at USC Beaufort. And we're here to talk about their wonderful trilogy, History of Beaufort County, and in the last two volumes, which go from one's from 1861 to 1893, and the other one from 1893 to 2006. And between the two, they're more than 1,000 pages. So first of all, gentlemen, welcome back to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter.
I know that the History of Beaufort County has been a project, Larry, literally that has been you've been working on for decades.
Yes, indeed.
And started off with the professor we had in common, George Rogers.
Correct.
Many years ago. And volume one came out, and then it was a while before we could get volume two.
It was my fault. Larry approached me to go ahead and write three chapters on the Civil War. I couldn't even do the introduction in three chapters. And 17 chapters later, I was able to deliver to Larry the period from 1861 to 1867. And during that time, Larry was able to finish his part up to 1893 and also finish volume three.
Okay. Wow.
I actually stopped writing in 2006. I just said, that's as far as I'm going to go. But it took us several years to finish volume two, which is the complexity of the Civil War occupation and reconstruction, which transformed Beaufort County and made it unique.
Well, I think that's what we need to hone in on. Beaufort County's experience is pretty much unique, not just in South Carolina, but in the South. And I'll warn our listeners, you'll hear Professor Rowland say that all history is centered on Beaufort County. He's incorrect there. It's on South Carolina, but, you know, I'll forgive him his parochialism.
But all of American history, including the history of South Carolina, started in Beaufort, South Carolina. Will that fulfill my obligation there, Walter?
Well, I think you've made the Chamber of Commerce very happy.
Yeah.
So, Larry, as a follow-up to your comment, a very brief history of Beaufort County before 1861.
Well, Beaufort County was the site of some of the earliest European Spanish landings and discoveries in the early 16th century, 1514, 1516, 1521, 1525, and 1526. The reason being because Port Royal Sound is the deepest natural harbor south of New York or the Chesapeake, depending on how you measure it. But it's the deepest natural harbor between the Chesapeake and Key West, and the earliest Spanish explorers discovered it, all being great sailors. So that's the beginning. The Spaniards had a city there and a port for a number of years. It was, at least briefly, the capital of La Florida. So there's a whole pre-English period of history that centers around Port Royal Sound. Then the Spaniards went broke several times and they just evacuated Port Royal and concentrated in St. Augustine. They evacuated Santa Elena, the city of Santa Elena, and they called it the Harbor of Santa Elena, a name that goes back to 1525. They abandoned that in 1587, concentrated in St. Augustine, and there was a 100-year gap in Spanish history. They call it the Siesta Colonial, which is pretty descriptive of the 17th century. And during that time, the British Empire was growing, and the British arrived in 1663 with William Hilton, 1667 with Colonel Sanford. They all came to Port Royal Sound. The name Port Royal derives from the French, who came in the 16th century in 1562 to found on Parris Island, under Captain Jean Ribaut, the first Protestant colony in the New World. Not Jamestown, not Plymouth Rock, but Parris Island, South Carolina. So that very early history is unique in American history, let alone South Carolina history. The English arrived in 1663, and the two earliest explorations in 1663 and 1667 both recommended beginning the English colony at Port Royal. And when they arrived, they found that that Spanish dominion still reigned over the Native Americans of the Sea Islands. And so on the recommendation of the local population, the Native Americans, they moved north to Charleston, which was an accidental circumstance. It was not what was recommended. But after the settlement of Charleston in 1670, which became permanent, the English moved down to the Sea Islands around Port Royal, using first the Indian trade in deerskin, then the cattle industry, which could be confined on the Sea Islands. And then eventually, by the end of the 18th century, Sea Island cotton.
And of course, rice plays into that as well.
And the rice rivers.
And Beaufort became the capital of the Sea Island planters.
Right. And the Sea Island planters became rich first with indigo, second with Sea Island cotton, and always with rice. And that changed the demography of the Lowcountry. It became predominantly African American. And those African Americans were almost all enslaved. So it became a very large and ultimately very prosperous for the white folks plantation society, one of the oldest, one of the largest, one of the richest in the American South.
And the demographics that you mentioned, the demographics of Beaufort County and at the other end of the state, George County, were almost identical to those of most of the English Caribbean islands.
Correct.
Sometimes 80 or 90% persons of color.
In the census of 1860, at the culmination of the antebellum period, the population of the Beaufort District was over 40,000. That's Beaufort, Hampton, and Jasper County today. It was over 40,000 folks, 35,000, actually close to 36,000 were African American slaves. So there's your demographics. And it was the site, so the Beaufort District became the site of some of the richest people in America and some of the largest slave owners in the American South. As a consequence, they became politically radicalized in the 1820s. The father of secession was raised in Beaufort. That's Robert Barnwell Rhett. And it became the heart and the origin of the secession movement. And all of that came to a crashing end on November 7th, 1861. And then I turn it over to Steve Wise.
All right. And that, as we turn it over, I think we should use the term that the majority of the population of Beaufort County referred that as the day of the big gun shoot.
The day of the big gun shoot.
All right, Steve.
Well, what Larry just described all comes crashing down on the day of the big gun shoot, November 7th, 1861. When a federal fleet arrives off Port Royal, and on that date, 17 warships, it was the largest squadron put together by the United States Navy up to that time, attacks Port Royal Sound, the two Confederate forts, Fort Beauregard on Bay Point, Fort Walker on Hilton Head. And just like with the Spanish that Larry mentioned, what brings them there is the natural qualities of Port Royal Sound, where they want to establish a naval station to blockade the coast.
We talk about these forts, and you know, people immediately would think about a Fort Sumter or Fort Pulaski, one of these great 1820 brick forts. We're not talking about things like that.
No, the Port Royal Sound, even though the United States Navy had surveyed it, declared it to be this wonderful position to establish a base, no fortifications were established before the Civil War, and the Confederates will build two earthen fortifications, log fortifications covered with dirt, again, one on Bay Point, one on Hilton Head. And these forts were supposed to be able to defend the area. But the Battle of Port Royal Sound is going to change naval history. One gun on land was supposed to be worth 5 to 10 guns on board a ship because these slow-moving sailing ships would come into the sound. You could fire out onto these vessels from your fixed fortifications. And as one of my friends always points out, forts do not sink. But this is a different battle. It's a battle of steam warships, and it's a battle where the United States Navy have larger cannon, 11-inch guns, on board their vessels than are in the Confederate forts. It's about a four-hour fight. They concentrate their fire primarily on the Confederates in Fort Walker. The Confederates will lose most of their cannon, will be disabled. The men will eventually begin to evacuate Fort Walker, and the Confederate commander, Thomas Drayton, will order a retreat from Hilton Head back to the mainland. The Confederates at Bay Point, when they see this occurring, will retreat across St. Helena Island, Ladies Island, back to Beaufort, and also back to the mainland. It's going to turn everything upside down because not only did the United States Navy defeat the Confederates and force the Confederate military to retreat, it also is going to cause the vast majority, not all, but the vast majority of your property owners to leave the area. They leave behind their homes, their property, and their African slaves.
Not always leaving them all behind. Mm-hmm. Didn't they select some of those who moved inland? Because that's, you know, Mary Chestnut talks about some of them would come and they brought the most valuable with them. They left the old and the very young on the island.
They left behind the vast majority of their field hands. They took with them a lot of their servants that would have been your house servants and such. But the ones left behind are going to be your field hands, and again, upwards of 8,000 of them. And the United States was not prepared for this at all. They did not expect all the owners to flee the area.
Okay. They really didn't expect the owners to flee. They thought the owners were going to stay there under occupation.
Yeah, the United States commander, this is a fellow by the name of Thomas West Sherman. We call him the other Sherman. He actually had a proclamation to informing the people, I haven't come here to change any of your social, economic, or political setups. He expected them to stay and take care of their plantations and take care of their slaves. And now suddenly he has upwards, again, of 8,000 masterless slaves on these sea islands, and he has no idea what to do.
And he also has the town of Beaufort, correct?
Beaufort will be occupied about 1 month after the Battle of Port Royal.
Okay. Was there any fight there, or the Confederates just withdrew?
The Confederates withdrew. There were some pickets at the town when the U.S. Navy came up. The Navy will patrol off Beaufort for about a month, but it'll be in early December 1861 that a brigade of Union forces will occupy the town of Beaufort and then spread out all over Port Royal Island. And that was the last major seizure of the Sea Islands. But all those Sea Islands around Port Royal Sound are part now of this Union installation that will grow throughout the war. So by the end of the war, it's one of the largest installations in the United States.
So we're talking about St. Helena, Parris Island, Port Royal Island, Ladies Island, Hilton Head?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And initially, Dufusky and Edisto, they evacuate Dufusky and Edisto about a year after its occupation.
That's a big chunk of present-day Beaufort County.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The thing you have to realize is there was no bridge to the mainland in those days, so it was isolated from the mainland. The only way on and off was by boat or by ferry boat. And, of course, the superiority of the U.S. Navy in that circumstance made the Sea Islands a fairly safe haven and a safe
It was a refugee area for escaped slaves. It was an area that the Navy helped slaves flee from the other sea islands all along the coast and brought them to Port Royal. And so as the war goes on, you're going to be building up from 8,000 upwards to 15,000 within months of people just fleeing from their plantation. Larry talks about one day the master comes out to check on his slaves and they're gone.
Mm-hmm. They escape by boat, by canoe, by sometimes the Union Army or the Union Navy facilitates the escape, but there was a great rush of refugees onto the Sea Islands. Steve knows the numbers, and it created the social experiment that became the Sea Island experiment.
And you actually had organized raids. There was a famous one by Sojourner Truth up the Cumbee.
Harriet Tubman.
Harriet Tubman.
Harriet Tubman was part of an expedition that went up the Cumbee in the spring of 1863. You had raids that went up to towns like Pocatello and Coosahatchee that carried back thousands of slaves as they raided the mainland. And the U.S. Navy just picked up, again, hundreds of slaves along the coast who would come out to the coast. And as Larry mentioned, they could come out in boats, bateaux, turn themselves over. And you not only had refugee camps established outside of Beaufort and on Hilton Head, but some of the outlying islands, like Otter Island, becomes a huge refugee camp. St. Simon's Island down in Georgia becomes a huge refugee camp for all of these escaped slaves.
And what's going to happen to these refugees? Who's going to feed them? Who's going to house them? What's going to happen?
Yeah, initially, the U.S. Army steps in, and the Quartermaster Bureau begins taking care of them. But again, this Thomas West Sherman appeals for help. And what eventually is going to occur is the United States Treasury Department is going to step in. Salmon Chase, the leading abolitionist in Lincoln's cabinet, sees this as an opportunity to put forward plans for reconstruction. He's always maneuvering to become the next president of the United States. And he's thinking, well, you know, let Lincoln handle the war. Once the war is over, they're going to need somebody to handle the Reconstruction of the South. I'm that man, and I'm going to use Port Royal as a place to start. And he is going to send down a fellow by the name of Edward Pierce, a Republican operative, had worked for Charles Sumner, had worked for Salmon Chase when they both were in the Senate. He comes down and makes a plan to take the refugees there and hire them out to the United States government to continue growing cotton that could then be sold to pay for the war effort. And he brings down superintendents who take over the plantations. He brings down teachers who set up schools. And this eventually is turned over to the War Department. But Pierce, Salmon Chase are the two guys who start this. And it begins what is sometimes referred to as the rehearsal for Reconstruction.
The Port Royal Experiment.
Because it's giving labor, it's giving pay, and eventually the federal government, through an interesting use of taxes, the former slaves will be able to purchase land. And this is what establishes this black community that still exists today on the Sea Islands.
Well, these teachers that come down, they're overwhelmingly female, are they not, Steve?
Initially, the vast majority of them are female. They come primarily from New York and Boston and later Philadelphia. They set up schools at almost all of the plantations, small individual schools that are run by these teachers. The most famous is Penn School, which still in sort of exists today. Now it's called Penn Center. But these are very dedicated women who come down. They run not only the schools during the week, but they also run the Sunday schools. And it changes, again, the whole atmosphere of the Sea Islands, because they have enrolled anywhere from 8 to 15,000 students. Most of them, the ages from about 8 to 20, but the adults will come to night school to learn how to read and write. And it's one of the most successful parts of the Port Royal Experiment is this educational system, which then rolls over after the war into really the first public education system in South Carolina.
It rolls over to the freedmen's schools, which were run by the federal government, and that rolled over after the Constitution of 1868 into the public school system of South Carolina. So the experiments that began public education began with the Port Royal Experiment on the Sea Islands of Beaufort County.
Now, let's talk about, we've got the education, that's part of the Port Royal Experiment, but let's talk about the paid labor. Let's talk about the lifestyles of those who came down as liberators and instructors. I've read accounts from the black community that they just had traded one master and missus for another. Is that incorrect?
That was the great fear. It took a while to win over the now masterless slaves at Port Royal that they were just doing that, trading one master for another. And slowly they come around to it. But what does occur, during the Civil War, the United States government passes a property tax. And this property tax is enforced through the area that has not seceded, but it also is enforced in areas where the North occupies regions in the South. And the Sea Islands will be a spot where they will enforce this property tax. The property tax was not much. It was a very, very small tax. In fact, I think for the entire Beaufort County, it was just about $10,000 to pay all the taxes in Beaufort County. But you had to pay in person, and the landowners were gone. And if they had come back to pay their taxes, then the Confederates would seize their property in areas that were still occupied by the South. So it's just sort of a typical taxation system where you are notified of your taxes. If you don't pay your taxes, you're notified again that you need to pay your taxes, and there's a penalty put forward. If you still don't pay your taxes, there's another penalty. And eventually the federal government, if you don't pay your taxes and your penalties, will foreclose upon the land. And once the land is foreclosed upon, it can be put up at auction. And what is going to occur is at the first auction, there are about 2-3 auctions during the Civil War, major auctions in the Port Royal area, is that some of these missionaries will be hired by companies, especially textile companies in the North, to buy up land for these textile companies and establish businesses to grow cotton and to hire the former slaves. And the former slaves did not like that at all. They wanted to have their own little homesteads and grow their own property. And you had this sort of philosophical fight between, well, should this be the next step in taking them from becoming a slave into a productive worker, was to make them sort of a factory worker, only an agricultural factory worker on a cotton plantation.
All right. And so this is going on throughout the war. Mm-hmm. Let's get up to 1865. Oh, no, we need January 1st, 1863. I think we need to throw in the Emancipation Proclamation, Larry, since you frequently read it on January. Are you used to?
I have done that. I'm going to turn this back over to Steve after this comment. There is a chapter that Steve wrote in this book that ought to be read by almost every student in America because it's inspirational on the event of January 1st, 1863, when the Emancipation Proclamation was read to nearly 10,000 slaves, many of them in U.S. Army uniforms. And it's one of the most inspirational moments in American history, in my opinion. And it deserves to be remembered. And in this book, it's very carefully and eloquently detailed. And Steve wrote it.
The Emancipation Proclamation, the reading of it, is going to occur at what's referred to as Old Fort Plantation, the Smith Plantation overlooking the Beaufort River. They begin preparing for this very early on, and they're actually going to steal a march on President Lincoln. They will have the ceremony before Lincoln even signs the final version of the Emancipation Proclamation. But that doesn't really matter. What matters, of course, what Larry mentions, is this tremendous ceremony to take them from sort of a nebulous status where they're referred to as contrabands to where now they can actually be called freedmen. Emancipation Proclamation is a wartime measure giving freedom to the former slaves who are in areas in rebellion against the United States. And they orchestrate this just a program that has a number of very important people, from Frances Gage, the very famous abolitionist feminist, all the way down to Henry Brisbane, a former South Carolinian, who will read the actual Emancipation Proclamation. And it gives status to the freedmen. It also swears in the 1st South Carolina, a regiment raised from former slaves on the Sea Island area. And what makes it almost very unique is that Brisbane was a former South Carolinian. The ceremony was repeated every year during the war and has been repeated ever since. Even today in Beaufort County, they still have Watch Night on the December 31st, awaiting January 1st when Emancipation Proclamation was proclaimed.
And Watch Night usually means a bonfire and a gathering.
I guess they do different things places today, but it's a party.
Oh, okay.
Let's party.
Excuse me, gentlemen. We need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking to Steve Wise and Larry Rowland about Volumes 2 and 3 of The History of Beaufort County. All right. The war is over. Planters who had gone into self-imposed exile begin to come back. What happens?
When these former planters, owners of property in Beaufort, come back, they find a whole different world. Not only that, they lost their plantations that have been broken up and sold to former slaves who now are growing their own Sea Island cotton, but also in the town, there's a whole new community. And it's a community based around northern immigrants who have come down during the war and former slaves, the most famous of which being Robert Smalls. Smalls, of course, known for taking the Confederate vessel Planter out of Charleston Harbor, turning her over to the blockading squadron. Smalls goes on to be a pilot for the United States Navy, for the United States Army's quartermaster vessels. He gets involved in politics very early on in Beaufort. He's part of a group that's sent up to the Union Presidential Convention, though he himself does not attend. He is one of the ones named to go up to it. His military duties interfere. And he becomes, as Larry points out in the book, the most essential man of the Beaufort area. He, through these tax sales, will buy his former master's home in Beaufort, around which is that wonderful, is a very interesting case that is carried out that goes to the Supreme Court.
There were many cases. They were called tax title suits. that were bundled into the Detreville versus Smalls suit that went before the Supreme Court in 1877. And the Supreme Court decided with the federal government, with Robert Smalls, and with all the property owners who had brought – the freedmen who had bought property under federal tax foreclosure sales auctions. And that ended that dispute. And the Southern planters who had returned, found little left, as Steve indicated, dispersed literally around the country. And fortunately, we found that they had finally received compensation in 1892 from the U.S. Court of Claims. Largely because the property that had been foreclosed on had been priced much lower than the property they had paid taxes on for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And so the difference in that, which were substantial sums of money, the federal government decided, with the help of now Congressman William Elliott, in the 1890s, that the federal government owed these folks some money. So they set up a fund in the Court of Claims. And the planters who had left Beaufort during the war could receive their compensation by petitioning the U.S. Court of Claims, which they did. And in the Carolinian Library is not only the record of the court's the claims against the U.S. Court of Claims, but it's Congressman William Elliott's personal copy with marginal notes. Oh. So we know where these many of these families went. And they went to Texas, they went to Florida, some in California, they went to New York, they went to Washington, D.C., all over the country, Wisconsin. And they seemed to succeed wherever they went because the one thing the planter class had was superior education. Mm-hmm. And even if they had to start over, they made it again. It's a remarkable story. We have the bones of it in Volume 2. And if anybody would like to write a good novel, just give me a call.
Okay. As you said, those folks who had – whites who had moved down during the war and who continued to come in, and they stayed, and they were probably more welcome in Beaufort than they were elsewhere.
They were not just welcome in Beaufort. They were absolutely essential because these were northern New England merchants that came down. They were missionaries and school teachers that came down. The interesting part of it, which Steve has written about, is that they really intended to create a social, political, and economic revolution in the American South, the rehearsal for Reconstruction, as Willie Lee Rose described it, the Port Royal experiment, as they described it at the time. But these folks were absolutely essential to rebuilding the whole society in Beaufort, and they stayed. The families that came, the northern merchants and families that came, they found prosperity, they acquired property, and they built an economy that was largely industrial. This is the thing that people kind of did not know or did not focus on, is that Beaufort County became one of the largest industrial centers, not only in South Carolina in the late 19th century, but the largest mining industry that the state of South Carolina has ever had was in Beaufort.
The phosphate mines.
The phosphate mines. And it was discovered by Southern scientists around Somerville before the war, but it was built up in Beaufort by northern merchants.
Yeah, and it succeeded until Ben Tillman taxed it out of existence.
That's correct.
And you also had a primitive naval base, which eventually would be moved to Charleston. So you had a fairly large federal government presence as well.
Yeah, the naval base is going to be, in a sense, you could argue, an outgrowth of the Civil War, because those who come back to help establish a warm water port for the Federal Navy after the war are, for the most part, officers who had served at Port Royal during the war. And Stephen B. Luce was in charge of the survey team that came down, went to Port Royal Sound and recommended Parris Island for a location of a new naval base. And in 1883, they began purchasing land on Parris Island for this naval station. And in early 1890s, the largest dry dock in the United States will be built on Parris Island.
And the naval base would remain there until Ben Tillman moved it to Charleston.
Yes.
For his own benefit.
For his own political benefit. Let me back up a couple of decades, because the naval station wouldn't have been there had not these northern merchants and U.S. Army engineers built the Port Royal to Augusta Railroad. The Port Royal and Augusta Railroad first connected the Sea Islands to the mainland of South Carolina. And the Port Royal and Augusta Railroad, which was opened in 1873, allowed the delivery of coal to Port Royal Harbor. That meant that Port Royal Harbor was not only the deepest natural harbor between the Chesapeake and Key West, a warm water port, as Steve described, but had regular deliveries of coal for the new steam navy that developed during and after the Civil War. So the Navy never really left Port Royal Sound. But after the railroad was built in 1873, then they sent the survey parties down, and then in May of 1877, they declared that Port Royal Sound was officially the United States Naval Station, Port Royal, South Carolina. And the whole Atlantic Fleet, the whole South Atlantic Squadron was stationed every winter there for nearly 20 years in Port Royal Sound.
Well, even with the industry, with the naval station, by the time you get to 1890, you still are dealing with a population that is overwhelmingly African-American.
And African-American political leadership.
Correct. The other great revolution that occurred in Beaufort County and stayed for many generations was political. The old white aristocracy was gone. They had to create a new political establishment. They had emancipated by the 13th Amendment, given civil rights by the 14th Amendment, and given voting rights by the 15th Amendment to this new population of American citizens. And they were 90% of the voting population of Beaufort County. So they elected Robert Smalls to the Constitutional Convention, the South Carolina Legislature, the South Carolina Senate, and for more than a decade to the United States Congress. And it, as a consequence, Robert Smalls and a legion of African-American lawyers and African-American political leaders controlled Beaufort County from 1867 until after 1895.
You end Volume 2, 1893. Any particular choice for that day?
Because something happens in 1893 that again changes the face of Beaufort County.
The Sea Island Hurricane of 1893, August 27th, 1893, literally transformed the history of Beaufort County. Didn't do it exactly overnight, but pretty much in one night. First of all, that hurricane is still listed as one of the top 10 natural disasters in American history. 2,000 people lost their lives in that hurricane. There was no warning for the hurricane. People living on the low sea islands were swept by a storm surge that may have been as high as 20 feet.
Well, I know on Edisto, it cleaned off Edisto.
It cleaned off Edisto. It cleaned off Hilton Head. There was only 300 or 400 acres of Hilton Head that was above water. So it was a colossal natural disaster. And, of course, it struck the small Sea Island freedmen and farmers hardest. Most of the 2,000 lives lost.
And almost all the livestock was gone. And
livestock was swept away. And crops were destroyed.
And it soured the land.
And it soured the land with salt water. It actually blanched the trees because it blew salt water through the oak trees and the pine trees. And it blanched them. So when after the hurricane passed, where you would look up and have seen green trees, they were all brown. And it took a year for the deciduous trees to recover from that. So they were either brown or barren for a year. It was really quite a cataclysm for Beaufort County. And it changed the history of the county. Several things were occurring which were contributing to that change other than the hurricane, but it was the marker. And it ended a long period of prosperity based on the phosphate industry and the naval station and the shipyard that Steve had described on Parris Island. And it began a half a century of decline and depression in Beaufort County. And it did pretty quickly.
Okay. The phosphate industry was pretty well decimated by the storm. And the taxation that Tillman put in finished it off. That and the phosphates in Florida.
Right.
But even Tillman would admit later on that he taxed the phosphates out of business.
Yes, and the phosphate companies were not owned by South Carolinians, which was his political interest. But there were a lot of different circumstances going on. First of all, Beaufort County, the best phosphate in Beaufort County, the best phosphate in America at that time, was found underneath the water of the Sea Islands, largely the Coosaw River, just because they never got to the Broad River or to Skull Creek or Calabogie Sound. But northern part of Beaufort County, it was 60% pure phosphate, which was the best known in the country at that time. And so there was a time in the 1880s when almost half of all the phosphate in the United States came out of Beaufort County mines, floating dredges and floating mines and barges. And it was a huge shipping industry, which was all vulnerable to the hurricane. I mean, all this stuff was sunk and turned over and crashed during the hurricane. And it was very expensive to rebuild that. And in the interim, in the late 1880s, landmines of rich phosphate deposits had been discovered east of Tampa, Florida. Mm-hmm. Those phosphate deposits are 80% pure phosphate. So you can see the economics changing. It's just cheaper to produce phosphate from 80% pure phosphate rock than it is from 60% pure phosphate rock. So the phosphate industry was going to go away anyway, and it was going to go away probably slowly because of the hurricane. It went away quickly, and it was a disaster for Beaufort County and a loss to South Carolina, frankly. The phosphate royalty that was collected in the 1880s was actually, I believe, Marty Davis has indicated in his articles that it was the largest single source of revenue of the South Carolina state government for nearly a decade, the phosphate royalty. And it disappeared by 1900.
All right. And so now we're really moving into volume three, the face of Beaufort economically, and it has certainly been changed. It took for a long time for the land to recover. And the situation was not only ignored, but was denigrated by the government in Columbia. Interestingly, people allegedly, agriculturists, couldn't understand how the land had been soured. It took years for the land to come back.
That's a very interesting story that I cannot be technically proficient in. But vegetables came back faster than cotton. Mm-hmm. So they could grow food, and it stimulated the growth of what became the truck farming industry in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But in the recovery for the hurricane, there was a great deal of politics. The Beaufortonians formed a biracial committee to appeal to the United States for relief, which they got from Philadelphia, New York, Boston, from Florida and Georgia. And then they went to the South Carolina legislature and asked for public money to help with the relief and did not get it from the South Carolina legislature. And that fact prevented the Florida legislature, the Georgia legislature, the North Carolina legislature from making contributions to this effort. And so the public contributions were simply not there. And what ended up was a very, very large private relief campaign run by the American Red Cross. It was, for many years, the largest relief effort done by the American Red Cross, well, in the 19th century.
All right. Let's move on into Volume 3 now and the 20th century. And you mentioned after the storm, everything has changed. The politics begins to change, too, in the 20th century. And I think we need to touch on that.
The politics change, and a lot of it is centered around what occurs at Parris Island and the old naval station. As you mentioned, that being pulled up to Charleston, you had this empty industrial center on Parris Island that no one was quite sure what to do about until the election of some new politicians from South Carolina and a new president of the United States.
Correct. Let me back up a little bit, because the South Carolina Constitution of 1895, which was the Jim Crow Constitution of South Carolina, and one of its principal objects was to restrain the black voting population, the black Republicans, and to enhance and try and lock in the power of the white Democratic Party, which they accomplished. In fact, there were only six black Republican delegates to the whole Constitutional Convention. Five of them came from Beaufort County. And they were led by Robert Smalls, the indispensable man of Reconstruction Beaufort, and William J. Whipper and Thomas Ezekiel Miller. And if you look into the records of that Constitutional Convention, you will see that some of the most eloquent speeches were made by this rear guard of the African-American political establishment of Beaufort County. Yeah. And that 1895 was the beginning of the decline and the suppression, literally, of the African-American Republican Party in the state of South Carolina in the beginning of 50 years of complete dominance of the white Democratic Party in the state of South Carolina and the rest of the South as well.
When the Great Depression comes on, Beaufort's already there.
Yes. Well, they lost their other major industry in 1901, as Steve indicated, which was the naval station. And that was an interesting political story because the Charleston commercial community wanted the naval station, the naval shipyard at Chicora Park on the Cooper River. And Pitchfork Ben Tillman was the senator on the was one of the senior senators on the Naval Affairs Committee of the U.S. Senate. And he and Major Adger Smythe conspired, literally conspired, to remove the naval shipyard from Parris Island, where the largest dry dock in the United States was at the time, and move it to Charleston. The principal reason that Andrew Smythe wanted to do that is because he knew if the Navy were on the Cooper River, that they would be compelled to dredge Charleston Harbor to 26 feet, which the naval, the battleships of the era needed. Fortunately, we don't have to worry about dredging Charleston Harbor anymore, do we? But it was so they literally, Charleston Harbor is only naturally 15 feet deep at low tide. And the large steamships of the Atlantic trade couldn't get in there at low tide half the time. So the Navy made the Naval Shipyard at Chicora Park, the Charleston Naval Shipyard, made the modern port of Charleston what it is in 1901. But it also removed all that naval and a lot of commercial activity from Port Royal Sound as a consequence. So that those politics were a huge blow, another blow to Beaufort County. And first of all, let me explain the effect of this. In 1890, this is a remarkable statistic that I ran into. The population of Beaufort County in 1890 was the same as the population of Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. And by 1940, 50 years of decline, the Beaufort County population had declined 38%. And 52% of the African American population had left Beaufort County.
The Great Migration.
The Great Migration. And in Beaufort County, the Great Depression. Because all of those folks were customers in the stores and employees in the businesses. And all of that just disappeared from Beaufort County in 50 years to the point where in 1935, all the taxable property in Beaufort County was worth $3.75 million. I mean, there are houses on Hilton Head worth a lot more than that today. In 1935, it was one of the poorest places in America. And the only real wages were paid in the vegetable truck farming business, and they averaged $90 per year. So it was desperately poor in the 1920s and 1930s. And the only thing that brought Beaufort County out of that deep, the Sea Islands, out of that deep, deep depression was World War II and the United States Marine Corps. And that changed for Beaufort County. It's a wonderful story on the other side, in addition to the terrible story of Beaufort County in the early 20th century. The only bright light was Parris Island and the United States Marine Corps. And that was the work of the inestimable Jimmy Burns of South Carolina. Because in 1910, James F. Burns was an Aiken lawyer, and he was elected to the United States Congress from the 2nd Congressional District, which included Beaufort County. And he worked to save the federal installations on Parris Island. And he didn't have a lot of he was our congressman from 1910 to 1925. And he didn't have a lot of success until the Wilson administration was elected in 1912 and installed in 1913. And when President Wilson became the second Democratic president since the Civil War and the first Democratic president since before the Civil War to be elected with a majority Democratic Congress. So they could actually do some things. And what he did is he appointed Wilson, as Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels of North Carolina, who was the publisher of the Raleigh Observer and the boss of the Democratic Party of the state of North Carolina and a big Wilson supporter. So he became Secretary of the Navy, just one sidelight. He and Wilson were both prohibitionists. It was Josephus Daniels who took liquor off U.S. Navy ships. I don't know how the sailors stood it, but he did it. Mm-hmm. And the sailors substituted black coffee for hard liquor. And they called the coffee a cup of Joe for Josephus Daniels. Well, he was very influential, one of the people who built the modern 20th century Navy. And he used to hunt every winter on Hilton Head Island with a group of men from Charlotte and Gastonia who had a hunt club down there. And Josephus Daniels loved the Sea Islands and Hilton Head and Parris Island. One of his first visits out of Washington was back to the Sea Islands and back to Parris Island. In April of 1913, he said, we're going to do something with Parris Island. He made good on his promise because at the end of that year, he sent the congressman from our district, Jimmy Burns, and his assistant secretary of the Navy to Parris Island to determine what would become of that federal property. and the Assistant Secretary of the Navy was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And those two men cemented that famous political friendship on Paris Island in December of 1913. They said this should become a Marine Corps training station, and by October of 1915, it became the first independent United States Marine Corps station in the world, and the cradle of the Corps and the beginning of the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, which Steve works for to this day, which provides more economic base for the northern part of Beaufort County than any other thing that's happened there in the 20th century. And it began with Jimmy Burns and Franklin Delano Roosevelt in December 1913.
Okay. Well, you end Volume 3 with a celebration of Charles Frazier, and I think that's where we come. You know, Alfred's been giving me a few signs, but I think we need to talk about that because that's another economic and social revolution in Beaufort County.
Yes. First, you have to understand that during World War II, the federal government put more money into Paris Island than all the value of Beaufort County combined, more, twice as much. And during World War II, when the population of Beaufort County was 24,000 people, 241,000 Marines went through Paris Island, 10 times the population of the county. That was the beginning of modern Beaufort County, which we know is one of the most prosperous places in the American South today. But it began with World War II and the Paris Island. And the other leg was Charles Frazier. Charles Frazier's father bought up timberland on the Sea Islands of South Carolina and Georgia right after World War II, where he had become, this is Lieutenant General Joe Frazier. And so as a teenager, Charles Frazier spent his summers on the south end of Hilton Head Island and recognized it as a paradise. So he went to Yale Law School principally to find out how you structure planned unit private developments. And he did that, became a world expert on the legal mechanisms creating planned unit developments. And he took his father's property at the south end of Hilton Head Island and he created Sea Pines Plantation. In 1956, he and his partners, not the South Carolina Highway Department and not the government, built a bridge that connected Hilton Head Island across Skull Creek to the mainland and began to sell Hilton Head Island. And today, what Charles Frazier started in 1954, really, at Sea Pines Plantation, has extended all the way from there to I-95. And if you drive that very busy highway today and look at all the commerce and all the business and all the jobs, and you realize that the southern part of Beaufort County is today the 12th fastest growing community in America. That began with Charles Frazier's vision, and he and Olin McIntosh and Fred Hack's bridge across Skull Creek.
Yeah. Well, when you were talking about the change in economics, I can remember giving my general talks on South Carolina history, and after 1990, I could no longer say there was not a single county in the state where the per capita income was not equal to that of the nation. Beaufort County was the first county in the state where the per capita income was greater than the national per capita income.
Right. I believe it is still the highest per capita income in the state of South Carolina.
Yes.
And it's a changed place, but it's changed because of what Charles Frazier did, and it's changed because of what the Marine Corps has done throughout the 20th century. And it's changed because of the incredible revolution that the Civil War brought to the Sea Islands.
What about the African-American community in Beaufort County and this prosperity?
The African-American community now represents, I believe, 23% of the population. Half of the African-American population left in the Great Migration before World War II. Mm. But since World War II, jobs and opportunity have been in Beaufort County. In other words, in the northern part of Beaufort County, there have been civil service jobs, thousands of civil service jobs, many of which have gone to African-American folks for years. And then booming commercial opportunities in the southern part of Beaufort County, which are available to African-American folks. So the jobs and opportunities are there, and a lot of the families are now staying. It's just that the demographics of northern migration is overwhelmed the traditional population of Beaufort County. Beaufort County was 24,000 people in 1940. It's now 180,000 people. So it's that in-migration of northern retirees and all the businesses that follow them. that has transformed the demographics of Beaufort County and left the African American population as a minority, but a fairly prosperous minority.
And actually, Native South Carolinians as a minority.
Oh, Native South. First of all, even in 1940, there weren't a whole lot of Native white South Carolinians in Beaufort County. I think 15% in the last census that I saw, which might have been 10 years ago, but 15% of the population of Beaufort County were actually born in Beaufort County. So the Native, and most of those were African American. So the white Native population is pretty small. And being one of those few people, half of my ancestors came from Maine. And an awful lot of the Native Beaufortonians were immigrants, you know, from Germany and
Austria.
Different places, Austria. Or they were Northerners. Mm-hmm. So it's a different place. And it's changed again with a revolution begun by the Marine Corps in World War II and by Charles Fraser in the 1950s.
Okay. All right. Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign. Anything you'd like to add, Steve?
Nope, I'm fine. It was a great time. I think we covered it fairly well.
I got nothing more to add. It was a wonderful interview, Walter. Thank you very much.
Well, delighted to have you both. Steve Wise and Larry Rowland, thanks again for being with us today on Walter Edgar's Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. It's always good to have Steve Wise and Larry Rowland back on the show. Larry and I have been friends and colleagues for years, and Steve is actually a former student. The history of Beaufort County is fascinating, and in some ways it is unique. In the 21st century, modern-day Beaufort is quite different from what it was in 1861 and 1893. But we discussed primarily the 19th century Beaufort that really set the stage for growth and development in the 20th century. And after World War II, it's a new story altogether. In fact, it's still being made. And as Larry would point out, that's really not history, that's current events. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.